I told him nobody knew nothing. I said, you didn't even know, and you were the closest thing to me, so let's just leave it at that. We had a good time, child, and if you're going to blow my brains out, go ahead and blow them out and get it over with and get that damn gun out of my face because you're scaring me to death. When I made that comment, he laughed, and he said, I'll admit I've had more fun with you than I've had with any bitch. I'm going to let you slide this time, but you better not pull that shit with nobody else or you're going to get hurt. That's why I don't play up in them black bars, honey. I don't need no gun to my head. What do white men do when they find out about your tea? I asked. Jeff didn't know when he first met me. I was in this straight club. I'd gone there with a bunch of my girlfriends. One of my roommates was a stripper. She was a real girl. And she would do her strip show, and I would do my drag show. And then we'd meet and go out to the straight bars and have a good time. I was just sitting at the bar having my cocktail and smoking my cigarette, and I saw Jeff. He was tall and blonde and gorgeous, and he just kept watching me. I said to myself, no, Shabley, don't even try. Don't mess with this straight man, 'cause this man is too tall. He will wrap you in a knot, girl. He sent a drink over, and I just nodded and thanked him. Then he came over and we started talking. He asked me to dance, and we danced. My girlfriend saw him, and they all wanted to trade boys with me. Later, we all went to my place and sat around and got high all night. Everybody was coupled off, just laying on their boyfriends, but there was no sex at all. When Jeff got ready to leave, he asked for my phone number, and I gave it to him. I'd forgotten he didn't know, 'cause I was carrying on saying Miss Thing and Yeah Girl, so it didn't even occur to me he didn't know. He called the next day and asked me to go out. It was so romantic. I bought a new dress, and we went to a ballroom that had a live band. Afterward, we went back to my place and started kissing. I realized I had to tell him, but I decided not to do it till the next night. Well, the next night he took me to a basketball game, and I ran into one of my old boyfriends. This old boyfriend was the insanely jealous type, which is why I had to leave him in the first place. So he started a bunch of shit saying, that's a drag queen you're with. And that's how Jeff found out. He was so hurt, he just walked off and left me there. I didn't hear from him for a week. Then he called me. He said he wasn't into men. I said, I'm not a man, bitch. Don't call me no man. Then he asked me, well, what do you got between your legs? I said, that's for me to know and for you to find out. So he said, well, whatever you are, I like you. I can't get you off my mind. And as long as we can be friends, I want to see you again. I said that was fine with me. So he started coming on my job and watching me do shows. And he got hooked. After a while, we started having sex, and we became lovers. I even went to see his parents. They live out on the south side. They're Baptists, honey, and they thought I was Jeff's girlfriend, Chris. I had Thanksgiving dinner with them, and Christmas, too, and they liked me and had no earthly idea. But after a few months, they realized I was not just a passing fling. Their son was really in love with me. That's when they had a problem. I was black. They started watching me very closely. I could feel it. They were looking to catch my ass in the slightest mistake. I really had to be on my guard. Then one time, they acted very strangely toward me. They were giving me funny looks, child. I could tell something was wrong. Jeff's mama got me alone after dinner. She said, Chris, let's you and me just sit here in the living room and have a little talk. Honey, the old girl was nervous as a cat. She said, Chris, there's something I've been wondering about. It's something that I know is very private with you, and I respect your privacy. But my son is involved with you, and I have to know. I want you to answer me truthfully. Well, child, my heart nearly stopped. I looked around just to check out where the door was in case I had to get out of there real fast. Then she said, "Tell me, honestly, are you pregnant?" Well, I was so relieved. For the first time in my life, I didn't have an answer. My mouth dropped open and I grabbed my stomach. When I did that, she screamed and ran out of the room. I just sat there for a while, not knowing what to do. I could hear all kinds of carrying on at the other end of the house. I sat there alone for about 10 minutes. Then Jeff walked in with the cutest little grin on his face. He said, "Okay, sugar, everything's fine, let's go." When we got outside, he was still grinning, and I said, "What the hell was going on in there? For a minute I thought your mama found out my tea." Jeff put his arm around me. "Whatever you said, baby, you said it right. Look what we got." Child, he pulled out the biggest wad of money I ever saw. He had 8 $100 bills. "It's from Dad," he said, "to pay for your abortion." Chablis clapped her hands. "I took the money them white folks gave us to murder their unborn grandchild, and I bought that color TV sitting over there and that video cassette player, too. And with what was left over, I went out and got me the raunchiest little sequin dress I could find, so in case they ever do find out who I am, I can shake my ass in their face and tell them thanks from the bottom of our interracial baby's dead little heart." Chablis got up and went over to the window.
"Ain't you finished yet, honey?"
she called. Jeff looked up from the street below. He was standing in front of the car. The two boys sat in the front seat, gunning the engine. He made a V sign.
"Be there in a second," he said.
Chablis turned back from the window.
"Yes, child, that abortion was some kind of good. I toyed with the idea of taking Jeff's folks to court for attempted fucking murder. If you pay to have somebody spiked, honey, that's attempted murder, ain't it?"
"Could be," I said, "under the right circumstances."
"Well, I didn't do it, 'cause I didn't want to hurt Jeff. And also 'cause I wasn't finished with them two motherfuckers. No, baby. 6 months later, we went back and convinced them I was pregnant all over again. That got us another 800, which paid for a few more gowns and a flawless weekend up in Charleston. But that's got to be the last of it. If we try it again, it'll dawn on them that it would be cheaper just to pay somebody to shoot me and throw me off the Talmadge Bridge."
Chablis put the dress aside and closed the cover on the bugle bead box.
"I don't see my in-laws anymore, but Jeff and me are closer than ever. Someday he'll go back to wanting girls, but I'm prepared for that. I just don't want him to leave me and go to a guy. I want him to go back to girls. If he goes to a guy, I'd feel awful bad. I dated one guy, and when we broke up, he started going with men. That hurt me so bad, and he couldn't understand why. I tried to tell him, 'I'm a woman. Treat me that way. It's the way I treat myself. I want a man who wants a woman, not a man who wants a man.'"
Jeff appeared in the doorway.
"Well, thank goodness," Chablis said. "I was getting tired of waiting on you. Another minute, I was going to start hitting on my new chauffeur. I am some kind of ready for you, baby."
Jeff lifted one of her feet and removed her sandal. She lay back on the sofa.
"'Cause Miss Myra's shots are starting to kick in, honey," she said softly.
He massaged her bare foot and stared into her eyes.
Yes, baby," she said.
I got up quietly and took my leave. As I closed the door behind me, I could hear Chablis murmuring,
"Yes, child. Yes, baby.
The pickup occupied a loft building on Congress Street. I could hear the thump, thump, thump of disco music as I approached the club's front door. Inside, a short-haired woman wearing jeans and a work shirt sat on a stool, chatting with a uniformed policeman. A handwritten sign on the wall read, $15 membership fee, but she waved me in without taking any money. The ground floor had a long, dimly lit bar and a dance floor with flashing lights and booming music. The place was crowded with young men in casual but for the most part conservative attire. A poster by the entrance announced the featured appearance of the Lady Chablis for two shows, at 11 o'clock and 1. The $3 admission charge was collected by a thin man who wore a baseball cap over his stringy waist-length hair. "The overture's already started," he said. The room upstairs was a narrow, low-ceilinged space with a bar at one end and a small stage and runway at the other. A revolving mirrored ball hung from the ceiling. About 50 people, including a number of couples, were taking their seats amid the din of the recorded overture, a scratchy, fast-paced medley of Broadway tunes played at extremely high volume in order to drown out the disco beat from below. As the overture ended, the room went black. The beat shifted to the pulsating rhythms of Natalie Cole's Jump Start. A spotlight hovered over the stage and then dipped. Chablis suddenly burst into view, looking like raging fire in a skimpy sequined dress with jagged red, yellow, and orange flame-like fringes hanging from it. She wore huge earrings and a wig of long black curls. The audience cheered as she strutted down the runway, working every nuance of the rhythm, shaking her behind like a pom-pom, whipping it from side to side. She looked over her shoulder with an expression of supreme sassiness. She was a minx, a temptress. She danced superbly, mouthing the words to the song and smiling as if tasting something delicious. The look in her eyes was light-hearted and outrageous. It seemed to say, "If you thought that last bump was vulgar, honey, watch this one." One by one, her fans rose out of the audience and moved to the edge of the runway. They held out dollar bills folded lengthwise. Chablis accepted their offerings without missing a beat, taking the money in her hands or allowing them the campy pleasure of slipping it into her cleavage. As the song came to an end, she exited to cheers and whistles and stomping feet. In a moment, Chablis's crackling voice came over the loudspeaker.
"Hey, bitches,"
she said. Members of the audience called back,
"Hey, bitch."
Chablis returned to the stage carrying a microphone in her hand. She was dabbing perspiration from her neck and chest.
"Ooh, child, I am sweating, honey, I truly am. And I'm not ashamed of it either. I want all you white folks to see how hard I'm working for you."
She wriggled as the audience cheered.
"I need another napkin, honey. Who's going to give me one? Whoever gives me a napkin wins a prize, and I ain't saying what that prize is until you win it."
A napkin was handed up from the audience.
"Thank you, baby. You are a true gentleman. Yes, you are, honey. I am serious. And you win the prize. You get to eat my pussy for the rest of my life, okay?"
The audience howled.
"Yes, honey, I am sweating, but I'm going to have to slow down soon. If I don't, the doctor says I'm going to have me another miscarriage. Yes, honey, I am with child again. My due date is getting closer, and my youngin' is dropping lower and lower. It's tough dancing in this heat when you're pregnant, you know. Have you ever tried it? Try getting pregnant like me and then come up here and dance, honey. Child, you'll be wore out. Are my feet swelling? Can you see 'em? Are they swelling? You know how your mamas did when she was pregnant with you. Do my feet look that way?"
The audience cried out,
"No." "I hope not, child, 'cause your mama had some ugly feet when she was carrying you."
Hoots and whistles from the audience. just kidding, she said.
I got a business deal to offer all you white boys. My husband's folks won't pay for no more abortions, and we're getting hard up for cash. Take me home to meet your mama and daddy, and tell them I am pregnant with your baby and see how fast they come up with the money. I'll split it with you 50-50. You don't think they'd do it?
Guess again, honey. My husband's daddy is a Baptist minister, and he's paid for it twice already.
That's mass murder, child. I am serious.
Chablis walked farther out toward the end of the runway, but after a few steps, the microphone cord snagged and stopped her short. She tugged at it, but it wouldn't come any farther. She turned toward the DJ's booth.
Michael! Miss Thing!
She tugged again.
Miss Thing, you ain't fixed this cord yet.
She looked to the audience.
Now I ask you, wouldn't you think Bert, the man that owns this damn club, would fix this cord so I could come all the way out into the audience and be closer to you? So I could touch you? So you could get those extra vibes?
A chorus of scattered yas came from the audience. If y'all can't do better than that, you can take your damn tired asses on home. I'm serious.
Now let me hear you holler, yeah, bitch. Yeah, bitch. Must be something wrong with my ears, child. I didn't hear nothing. Yeah, bitch. That's better. Yes, child. Now I can feel your presence.
Chablis ran her hand down the side of her dress and shimmied.
Yes, I can feel you are here, child, even if I can't reach out and touch you the way I usually do, and would do right now if it weren't for this sorry-ass cord.
Whistles and catcalls.
Maybe Bert thinks I'll break down and get it fixed myself. Do you think I should? Do you? No way, baby. I ain't giving up my coins for no cord, honey. Your mama's gonna be shopping for gowns. Give me any length of cord you got, and I will play with her. Yes, girl, long or short, I will play with your cord. Whatever size it is, honey. 'Cause your mama's gonna start acting like the heterosexual pregnant white woman she is, and keep her fucking money in her pocket.
The audience cheered. Chablis undulated in place.
Just kidding, honey, she purred.
Okay, gang, I want to thank you for coming tonight. If I offended anyone, two tears in a bucket, honey, motherfuck it. Yes, child.
We have a wonderful show lined up for you. We have a whole bevy of beautiful bitches, so I want you to put your hands together now and welcome to the stage the...
Chablis looked down at a man and a woman sitting at a table by the edge of the runway.
You two have been necking and carrying on all through my number. No, 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 that's all right, baby. I don't mind.
Get it while you can, honey.
But tell me something, girl. Is he your husband or your boyfriend?
He is?
Well, I think I should tell you. Him and me has been fucking since Christmas time. Yes, honey, he is the father of my baby. That's right, child. Where y'all from?
Hilton Head.
And what does the father of my baby do besides fuck real good?
A lawyer? Ooh, my youngin's gonna have a rich daddy.
When you become a lawyer, honey, you get to have all that stuff after your name, don't you? Like Esquire and Attorney at Law.
I don't need nobody telling me about lawyers, child. You get messed up with Reefer and the cops, honey, you gonna know about Esquires and Attorney at Laws. You gonna know lawyers.
But your wife don't get none of that shit after her name, does she? She just gets to carry the baby, huh?
Well, let me tell you something, child. I get something better after my name.
I get applause, honey, and people yelling, "Hey, bitch!"
Chablis slinked along the runway as the audience cheered,
"Hey, bitch!"
And I get something even better than that coming after my ass, she said.
I get some fine stuff coming after my ass, child. I bet all you bitches wish you did too, don't you?
Chablis looked into the spotlight.
Miss Thing,
Shine the light over there.
Chablis pointed in my direction, and in a moment I was blinded by the spotlight.
I want y'all to meet my new chauffeur,
she said.
Yes, child, my new white chauffeur, honey. He drives your mama's black ass all over Savannah. Soon as he learns how to drive a little better, honey, we be getting a Rolls Royce. That's right, nothing's too good for the lady, I am serious. Nothing's too good for the doll. Okay, Miss Thang, that's enough with the light. Bring the light back to Mama. Thanks, honey. Now I want y'all to enjoy the show. Have a good time. And don't let me catch none of you bitches laying a hand on my new chauffeur. Cause if I catch you, child, you will have Chablis to deal with. That's right, honey, me and my ice pick.
Chablis turned and undulated back up the runway. When she reached the curtain, she looked back over her shoulder and whispered into the microphone,
Just kidding, honey.
Chablis was followed by Julie Ray Carpenter, who was a foot taller and at least 80 pounds heavier. A curly-headed blonde, Julie Ray had a dimpled smile and wore a bright blue, ill-fitting taffeta dress that you could tell from the puckered stitching was homemade. She skipped and bounced and twice flung herself spread-eagle against the back wall for dramatic effect, but she did it without a hint of irony, and without a clue how embarrassing it was to watch her. About a dozen members of the audience gave Julie Ray tips. An equal number got up and left. As I sat watching her, a waiter in a floppy straw hat tapped me on the knee. Chablis asked me to bring you backstage, he said. He led me around to a cramped dressing room shared by all the members of the show. They were adjusting their hair and makeup at a long dressing table. Chablis was wearing only pantyhose. She caught my reflection in the mirror.
Hey, honey, she said. I hope you ain't mad at me after what I done to you out there, shining that light in your face and talking dirty and all.
We're still friends, I said.
That's good, honey. But I guess that lawyer from Hilton Head won't be coming back soon. I was watching him the whole time, talking and necking with his fish while I was doing my number, and honey, I will not take that. Lucky for him he backed down when I got into his shit about it. Cause if he hadn't, I would have got meaner.
Chablis removed her wig and combed her natural hair into a pompadour.
I've gone as far as taking off my shoe and hit people over the head to prove to them that, you know, don't let this dress fool you.
Last weekend in Valdosta, a girl was talking real loud, and when I started in on her, she threw a beer at me. She was one of those real mean lesbians, honey. She was a pit bull dyke. But what she failed to realize was that there was a whole pitcher of beer sitting on her table. I baptized the bitch, honey. I baptized the bitch. Well, how did your boss like being called a cheapskate? I asked.
Child, that was nothing. I let him off easy, cause I remembered my pay envelope was downstairs at the bar. I was afraid he might not let me have it if I was too rough on him. I'll get him later, though.
Julie Ray came off the stage and was followed by Stacy Brown, a tall, elegant black. Next up was Dawn Dupre, a statuesque blonde with long, straight hair and very modish clothes. Chablis told me Dawn was a professional seamstress.
She made the dress I just wore, she said. Did you like it?
Very impressive, I said.
It was perfect for my slut routine, but I'm doing something different for my second song. Something just for you, honey, something very demure. I'm gonna do my uptight pussy debutante number in a floor-length gown. I'd wear pearls, too, but I ain't that pure. Gonna have lots of rhinestones instead. The dress has a slit up the back, too, all the way up to my ass. But I'm gonna move real slow and sedate, being the lady that I am.
Slow dances are good for business. They make it easier for my fans to come up and give me tips. When you dance fast and dirty, it intimidates some of them. And it's hard for them to get to you, too, while you're jumping around. fact, I gotta put that girl on quick. It's almost my turn.
Shebly riffled through a long rack of dresses.
This is my drag, honey, she said.
The rack held 50 or 60 dresses in a rainbow of colors, most of them sparkling with sequins and rhinestones. There were fluffs of marabou, ripples of velvet and satin, and clouds of tulle. She held out a red strapless gown.
This is the dress I won Miss World in, she said.
She pointed to a blue one.
And this one was my Miss Georgia dress. If you ever pass a dress shop and want to be nice to the doll, honey, just remember I'm a lady's small, size 6.
Chablis stood, virtually nude. Her torso was an ideal woman's shape, narrow-shouldered, full-breasted. Her hips were a bit on the slender side, but I noticed there were no bulges in her pantyhose.
"Ooh, baby," she said. "I just clocked you checking out my pussy. You didn't see nothing, I hope."
"Nothing at all," I said.
"Good, 'cause if you ever see anything in my panties, child, you tell me. You say, 'Girl, your cotex is showing,' and I will shift her, honey, because I cannot take that. That is a ugly sight. That is a nasty-looking thing, honey, to be out there all painted with your dick showing."
Julie Ray looked up from her makeup.
"Really, Chablis," she said. "That's why I wear a gaff," Chablis went on.
"What's a gaff?" I asked. Chablis looked at me with genuine surprise.
"You never heard of a gaff?"
"No. What is it?"
"A gaff is a girl's best friend," she said. "It holds her dick in place." "Chablis!"
Julie Ray blurted out through a mouthful of bobby pins.
"Sister hates it when I talk this way. Don't you, Miss Thing?"
Julie Ray didn't answer. She was piling her blonde curls into a Gibson Girl upsweep. Chablis turned back to me.
"It's a trade secret, honey, and Miss Thing thinks I spoil the illusion when I talk about us girls having dicks and all."
Chablis picked up a small rectangle of pink cloth with two narrow elastic loops attached to it.
"This is a gaff, honey. It's something like a G-string. What you do is, first you pull your stuff back between your legs, and then you step into the gaff and pull it all the way up. You shove your ovaries up inside you, too. I call my testicles my ovaries, honey."
Chablis looked wide-eyed at me.
"Child, you should see the look on your face."
"I can't think of anything more painful than what you just described," I said.
"Then don't let me tell you what we do with duct tape."
Chablis didn't wait for me to stop her.
"Duct tape is for when you want to be butt naked. You tape your stuff back inside the crack of your ass, honey, and nobody knows the difference. But you talk about pain? She's a painful girl to pull off. And getting a hard-on in that position ain't no picnic either."
Julie Ray slammed her hairbrush down and left the dressing room.
"There goes Miss Thing all in a huff," said Chablis. "She'll get over it, though. She's a good girl, and I love her, and she knows it. And she's right, anyway. This bullshit ain't as easy as it looks. It takes me 20 minutes just to do a daytime face. Eyeshadow, eyeliner, mascara, rouge, lipstick. 20 minutes, honey. And it takes an hour to get ready for the show."
Julie Ray came back into the dressing room. Chablis gave her a rueful look.
"Okay, Miss Thing," she said. "I'm through talking that shit. I ain't giving away no more secrets. I'm sorry I did it. Yes, I'm sorry, baby, all the way down to my real live pussy. Do you forgive me?"
Julie Ray smiled in spite of herself.
"Good, honey," said Chablis, "'cause us girls has gotta stick together. Oh, child, there's my cue."
Chablis took a midnight blue evening gown off a hanger and slipped into it. The dress was high-necked and hung straight to the floor. A solid cape of rhinestones sparkled across her shoulders.
"Zip me, honey," she said.
I zipped her.
There was indeed a slit halfway up the back. But the song was a slow-moving ballad, and Chablis swayed sinuously rather than bumped. She used her shoulders to express the emotion of the song, and her fans stood in line to give her tips. When it was over, Chablis took the microphone again to thank the audience for coming.
"If you liked the show," she said, "thank you from the bottom of my heart, and just remember my name, the Lady Chablis. If you didn't like the show, honey, my name is Nancy Reagan, and go fuck yourself."
Chablis came backstage and took off the long gown.
"My lawyer from Hilton Head learned his lesson," she said. "He tipped me $20.
She put on a lime green silk mini dress with tiers of swaying beads.
"Now it's time to go downstairs to the bar, pick up my money, and have an apple schnapps and a cigarette."
She applied some lipstick.
"Then I'll come back up for the second show, get into one of my nastiest bump dresses, and ream Bert's stingy ass from here to kingdom come."
Downstairs, the disco music was deafening. I followed in Chablis' wake as she made her way through the crowd to the bar. She greeted her fans as they approached, turning her head so they could kiss her on her neck and not smudge her makeup or muss her hair.
"What, honey?"
she said. "You missed the show?" "That's okay. You can take that tip and stuff it into my bosom right now." "There you go. Ooh, child, thank you, honey." "Hey, baby, how you doing?" "Okay, girl, sister's looking good." "Oh, child, you still got that number you was here with last week?" "Yeah?"
"Tell me quick."
"Pour the tea, girl, pour the tea." "All right." "No, honey, I did not bring my husband with me tonight. He's waiting on me at home, saving his big old hard-on just for me."
By the time Chablis reached the bar, her apple schnapps was waiting. She took it and raised her glass to the squat, thick-shouldered man standing next to her.
"Hey, Bert," she said. "Two tears in a bucket."
She downed the drink. Bert had a shiny, bald head and sad eyes. "How you doing, Chablis?" he asked.
"Well, I ain't on food stamps yet," she said, "but I'm getting real close. It's a good thing y'all don't pay me any more than you do, or I might never qualify."
Bert didn't answer.
"Speaking of which," she said, daintily holding out her hand, "may I have the envelope, please?"
Bert gave her a small envelope.
"Thank you, honey," she said. "You coming up to see the second show?"
"Yeah, I guess so," Bert said.
"That's good, 'cause I always do a better show after I've had my apple schnapps. And, honey, you don't want to miss the second show tonight."
Chablis looked inside the envelope.
"Where's the rest of it?"
she said.
"The rest of what?"
said Bert.
"My money. I'm $100 short. Y'all been taking money out of my pay."
"Oh, well, yeah," Bert said. "That was because of the two shows you didn't work. We didn't pay you for those." A flash of anger sparkled in Chablis' eyes.
"Bert, that's a bunch of shit," she said.
"What do you mean?" said Bert.
"Maybe I wasn't in front of that spotlight, but I was in front of my makeup mirror, and that's work right there. Then I caught a cab to come down here, and I got here on time. No one ever called me to tell me the shows were canceled. I get a salary, that's our agreement."
Bert gave Chablis a weary look. "If you don't work, Chablis, you don't get paid. That's the way it is."
"Bert, my rent is due, goddammit. How am I going to pay my rent?"
"You'll have to talk to Marilyn," said Bert. Marilyn was the bookkeeper.
"I ain't talking to nobody. I want my money."
Bert sighed. "Chablis, I'm not going to argue with you. I'm tired. Fair is fair." Chablis slammed her hand down on the bar.
"Then fuck it," she said.
Watch this. She turned and cut quickly through the crowd, pausing briefly for a whispered conference with Julie Ray. Then she charged up the stairs with Bert in close pursuit.
Chablis, Bert called after her. What are you doing?
Give me my money, she demanded.
But you didn't work.
Yes, I did.
In the dressing room, Chablis grabbed a handful of dresses off the rack.
I'm taking my drag home, she said. I'm quitting.
Chablis, please don't, said Bert.
He took hold of the dresses, and for a moment the two of them were locked in a tug of war.
Don't you go pulling my beads, child, said Chablis.
Bert, suddenly embarrassed, let go. Julie Ray appeared in the doorway behind Bert. She was accompanied by a half-dozen people she had brought up from downstairs. Chablis tossed the dresses over Bert's head. Julie Ray caught them and handed them out to the people in the hall.
"Keep 'em coming, Chablis," she said. "We're with you, babe."
Chablis took another handful of dresses from the rack, but this time Bert raised his arms to block her way.
"Chablis," he said, "you're forgetting something. You borrowed $100 from us 6 weeks ago, and you haven't paid us back."
Chablis paused for a moment.
"That's true," she said, "but you never gave me a deadline. You could have warned me you were going to cut my pay, especially when my rent was due. And somebody could have called to tell me the shows were canceled. I could have got booking somewhere else. I could have went to Columbia. The tips in Columbia are flawless."
"Well, I'm sorry, Chablis," said Bert, "but I can't let you take anything out of here until you pay back the loan."
Chablis thrust a silver lamé dress at Bert.
"Here," she said, "take this dress. It's worth $100 and it'll make us even. Now I'm hauling my shit out of here."
Bert stared blankly at the dress. It was a piece of silver cloth no bigger than a tea towel. It hung limp in his hand.
"What am I supposed to do with this?" he said.
"Wear it," said Chablis. "And here's a little something else, in case you want to hide your dick while you got it on."
She shoved a gaff into Bert's hand. Julie Ray squealed with delight. Bert dropped the gaff with a look of disgust.
"Chablis," he said, "the trouble with you is..."
"Don't start," said Chablis. "'Cause I know what the trouble with me is. The trouble with me is I buy a whole wardrobe of gowns, and then I spend hundreds of hours sewing on beads and sequins and rhinestones, and I don't get paid for any of that. I buy records so I can learn new songs, and I get hormone shots for $20 twice a month to maintain my feminine image, and nobody pays me for that either. Then I spend hours fixing my hair and making my face and getting into my drag so I can come down to this filthy pisshole of a place that looks like somebody's attic and do my best to create an illusion of glamour. Honey, the rafters in here are so low I'd be afraid to come out on that stage wearing a tiara."
Chablis glared at Bert, her dark eyes blazing.
"Well, Chablis," he said, "if you..."
"The trouble with me is I work for a man who thinks he's doing me a favor by letting me parade around on his stage. He thinks I have so much fun putting on dresses and shaking my butt that I don't care if I get paid or not. Well, let me tell you something. There are times when I don't feel like putting on a dress or making my face. But I come down here and do it anyway because it's my job. It's how I make my living. And I'll tell you something else. It's damn hard work being a girl full-time."
"Chablis," said Bert, "you're not being fair. You know I think of you as family."
Chablis sighed. She had one hand on her hip and a sardonic smile on her face.
"Sure, baby," she said softly. "I suppose that's why you got that sign down by the front door that says $15 membership fee. The fee that only black folks are asked to pay, 'cause black folks are not welcome in this club as guests, only as the hired help. The hired help that don't always get paid."
Chablis took another handful of dresses off the rack.
"Stand back, bitch," she said.
This member of the family is leaving home.
The hall outside the dressing room was now crowded. Chablis tossed out gown after gown.
Hold him up high, honey. Don't drag the drag. Hold him up over your head, baby.
When the rack was empty, Chablis turned to Bert. He was still holding the silver lamé dress.
Don't forget your gaff, Bert, she said. You're gonna need it to hide your dick when you wear that dress.
Bert said nothing. Chablis shrugged.
Suit yourself, she said. But when the time comes and you ain't got a gaff to wear, what you gonna do, huh? I'll let you in on a little trade secret. There's something else that works just as good as a gaff. Put on 4 pairs of pantyhose. Do that, honey, and everyone'll swear you got a pussy.
Chablis tossed the last dress to Julie Ray.
Okay, Miss Thing, she said. I am ready.
Then down the stairs she went, followed by a cascade of glitter and fluff. Chablis strutted out onto the dance floor, her long train of gowns floating behind her like a colorful, twinkling Chinese dragon. Other dancers joined the line, raising their arms to support the winding canopy of dresses. Chablis was radiant.
"Ooh, child," she called out. "I wish my mama could see me now."
She bumped and wiggled and shook her butt. The gown-bearers fell into step behind her, hooting and hollering as Chablis led them snaking around the dance floor, into the bar, down its entire length, past the man with the baseball cap and the stringy hair, past the sign that read $15 membership fee, and out into Congress Street. She turned and headed east, still dancing to the music, her long train flowing out behind her. The streetlights glinted off the rhinestones and the sequins, igniting sparks of light in the billows of peach and red and green and white.
"It's like I told you, honey," she called out as she passed me. "You're gonna have to travel if you want to see me do my shit from now on. Macon, Augusta, Atlanta, Columbia, they all know the doll, honey. They all know Chablis."
Traffic on Congress Street slowed to a crawl in order to take in the glittering procession. The air was filled with honks and whistles and shouts in a mixture of good-natured cheer and lusty derision. The motorists were unaware, of course, that the spectacle they were witnessing was that of the Grand Empress of Savannah parading every wig, gown, and gaff in her imperial wardrobe. Chablis waved to her subjects.
"Sister's moving out," she shouted. "Yes, honey. Mama's on the move. I am serious, child."
Chapter 8 Sweet Georgia Browns.
"Lord, you Yankees are something else," said Joe Odom. "We do our best to set you on the straight and narrow, and look what happens. First you take up with folks like Luther Driggers, whose main claim to fame is he's getting ready to poison us all. Then you drive around in an automobile that ain't fit to take a hog to market in, and now you tell us you're hanging out with a nigger drag queen. I mean, really. Your mama and daddy are gonna pitch a fit when they hear about this, and I reckon they'll blame it all on me."
Joe was seated at a table in a huge warehouse space that was soon to open its doors as Sweet Georgia Brown's, a piano bar with an 1890s atmosphere. Joe Odom was to be the proprietor, president, and featured performer in a 3-man jazz combo. He was just now writing checks and handing them out to the workmen who were putting the finishing touches on the place. A carpenter was buffing the U-shaped oak bar to a lustrous sheen. In the center of the U, a white merry-go-round horse reared up over a hillock of liquor bottles. Mandy, who was to be part owner of the bar and a featured vocalist, stood on a ladder focusing spotlights on the bandstand, where Joe was having an afternoon scotch and signing checks. Joe's parting from Emma's had been perfectly amicable.
Under the circumstances, it had been the only gentlemanly thing he could have done. His part ownership of Emma's had drawn all of his creditors out of the woodwork, and they had pounced on the little bar with writs and lawsuits in the manner of depositors staging a run on a failing bank. Joe had become a liability to Emma's, so he withdrew and took the warehouse space across Bay Street. He wasn't really sure how Sweet Georgia Brown's would be any less a target of his creditors than Emma's had been. An indifferent shrug was the best answer he could give to that question. Meanwhile, Joe and Mandy had been evicted from 101 East Oglethorpe Avenue for non-payment of rent. They had taken up residence a few blocks away in a handsome white frame house on Pulaski Square. Joe's entourage followed him to his new house, and so did the tour buses. The only people who were unaware that Joe had moved into the house were the absentee owners and the real estate agent, John Thorson, who had taken him through it. Joe had pretended to be undecided and in no particular hurry the afternoon Mr. Thorson had shown him the empty house. The next day, Mr. Thorson departed for a 6-month stay in England, and the day after that, Joe moved in. Furniture, piano, entourage, and all. He was a glorified squatter, but no one knew it at the time. By the end of the first week, Joe was giving tours and lunches at $3 a head. He greeted the tourists with a slightly altered version of the welcoming speech he had used at his other houses. "Good afternoon. My name is Joe Odom. I'm a tax lawyer, a real estate broker, and a piano player. I live in this house, which was built in 1842 by Francis Bartow, a Confederate general who died in what we like to call the War of Northern Aggression. Feel free to walk around and make yourselves at home. If you see a closed door, though, please don't open it, because you're likely to find dirty socks and unmade beds and maybe even people sleeping in them." Mandy climbed down from the ladder. She was wearing a tight, floor-length beaded gown with a plunging neckline. A peacock feather was attached to her bejeweled headband. She had been trying on her Diamond Lil costume to go with the 1890s theme of the place. "How do you like my look?" she said, striking a sexy pose against the piano.
"I like it just fine," said Joe.
"Marry it, then," she said.
Joe gave Mandy a kiss. Then he went back to the business of writing checks. He gave one to the man who had installed the lights. He gave another to the carpenter, and a third to the general contractor. Joe and the men bantered lightheartedly, as if all of them really believed the checks were good. After the workmen had left, an old black man appeared beside Joe at the piano. He was leaning on a cane. He had been at the bar most of the afternoon, making coffee for the workers and keeping the place swept clean.
"Quitting time, Mr. Odom," he said.
He cast a glance at the checkbook. Joe shook his head.
Chester. You don't want to fool with those things. Always insist on the real McCoy when you can get it."
He pulled out his wallet and gave the old man the only bill in it, a $20. The man thanked him and hobbled off.
"Now, about these folks you've been consortin' with," said Joe, turning his attention once again to me.
"I don't know," I said. "I kind of like the people I've been meeting in Savannah. I'll admit I might have to upgrade the car, though."
"Then maybe there's hope after all," he said.
He lit up a cigar.
"'Cause, you know, Mandy and I are fixing to rent a house with a pool out in Hollywood for when they make the movie out of that book of yours. But it's starting to look like our co-stars are going to be nothing but a bunch of creeps. We need to do something about that."
"Who do you have in mind?" I asked. "The mayor?"
"Lord, no, not him," said Joe.
He thought for a moment.
"We've got a lady staying with us at the house that you might be interested in. Writes a sex therapy column for Penthouse Magazine."
He looked at me expectantly.
"No?
No." I reached into my pocket and took out a note I had jotted to myself. As it happens, I said, I am about to widen my circle of acquaintances. See if you approve. I handed him the note. It read, Jim Williams, Mercer House, 429 Bull Street, Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. Joe nodded with the solemnity of a jeweler appraising a rare gemstone.
Well now, he said, this is much better. So much better. Jim Williams is a stellar individual. He's brilliant, successful, much admired. A little arrogant, maybe, but rich. And the house ain't bad either.
Chapter 9. A Walking Streak of Sex. And so it happened that I spent that extraordinary evening in Mercer House in the company of Jim Williams and his Fabergé trinkets, his pipe organ, his portraits, his Nazi banner, his game of psycho dice, and, briefly but memorably, his tempestuous young friend, Danny Hansford.
"Well, what did you think?" Joe Odom asked me when I stopped in at Sweet Georgia Brown's afterward.
"I think I've met the young man you found in your bed," I said. "The one with the tattoos and the Fuck You T-shirt. He works for Williams."
"So that's who it was," said Joe. "He must be the kid who drives that souped-up Camaro that's always parked in front of Mercer House. He hot-rods it all over town. Whips around the squares like they were his own personal Indy 500.
Danny Hansford was unknown to most of the residents of Monterey Square. At best, he was a nameless presence, someone seen entering and leaving Mercer House, parking and taking off in his black Camaro, wheels squealing. One of the few people who had met him was an art student named Corinne, who lived on the top floor of a townhouse just off the square. Corinne had soft white skin and a tumbleweed of auburn hair. She designed her own clothes, which were always black, and usually emphasized her best features, her bosom and her buttocks. She breakfasted regularly at Clary's drugstore, and she wasn't ashamed to admit that she knew Danny Hansford.
"He's a walk-in streak of sex," she told me.
Corinne had watched Danny from afar long before they had ever spoken. He was in his late teens, she surmised, roughly her own age. She was thrilled by his lean, muscular body, his tousled blonde hair, and his tattoos. She was particularly taken with his walk, a cocky strut that said, "Fuck you," as boldly as the T-shirt he wore so often. He was a motion study in energy and turbulence, never looking right or left, or acknowledging the presence of other people on the street, except on one occasion that she vividly recalled. She was crossing Monterey Square one afternoon when she heard the roar of Danny's Camaro coming down Bull Street. She quickened her step so as to put herself in front of Mercer House as he pulled up. He bounded out of the car and came face to face with her. He smiled shyly. Corinne congratulated herself on having put on a skin-tight jersey top and a skimpy skirt that morning. She stood squarely in his path and said hello. She asked if he lived in the big house.
"Yeah," he said, "I sure do. Want to come in and see it?"
"You bet I did," Corinne told me months later in Clary's drugstore, as she recounted in precise detail what happened after that. She followed him up the walk, she said, her eyes fixed on the seat of his jeans, the back of his T-shirt, his arms. But when she stepped into the cool vastness of the entrance hall, she forgot, momentarily, about all that, and gaped in silence at the sight before her. The spiral stairs, the portraits, the tapestries, the crystal chandeliers, and the gleaming furniture.
"Good God," she murmured.
Danny stood with his hands in his pockets, rocking on his heels and eyeing Corinne. He had a boyish face, a pug nose, and sensuous lips that seemed to be fighting back a grin.
"All this shit comes out of castles and palaces," he said.
"This is a castle," Corinne replied in an awed whisper.
"Yeah," said Danny. "And it's worth a couple $1,000,000, too. Jackie Onassis tried to buy it off us once. She was the president's wife, you know. But we told her, 'It ain't for sale, lady.' Man, we told that Jackie Onassis to fuck off."
Danny laughed at the idea of it. He scratched his chest, hoisting his T-shirt slightly and revealing a glimpse of washboard stomach.
"Come on, I'll show you around."
They were alone in the house. As they walked from room to room, Danny gestured at the portraits on the wall.
"All these guys are kings and queens," he said. "Every damn one of them. And the metal stuff is gold and silver, too. Man, we got burglar alarms all over the place. Anybody tries to break in here, man, they're gonna get the shit kicked out of them. I hope I'm here when somebody tries it. Yeah, 'cause nobody fucks with me and gets away with it."
Danny cut the air with a karate chop and then quick-kicked the imaginary intruder.
"Hi-ya! Chung, chung! Eat it, motherfucker!"
They moved into the dining room, where Corinne paused before an oil portrait of a periwig gentleman in a ruffled neckcloth.
"Who's that?" she asked.
Danny looked up at the painting.
"That fat sumbitch up there? He's a king, like I told you."
"The king of what?" she asked. Danny shrugged.
"The king of Europe."
Corinne started to say something in reply, but caught herself. Danny glanced at her with a look of uncertainty, and then abruptly headed back into the living room.
"Hey," he said, "let you and me have a drink. Then maybe we can go upstairs and shoot some roulette. Would you like that?"
He poured 2 tumblers of vodka and handed 1 to Corinne. Before she had taken 3 sips, he had drained his glass. He looked at her with an impish grin.
"Come on, let's go upstairs."
In the ballroom on the 2nd floor, they spun the roulette wheel a few times. Then Danny pounded out a crude rendition of Chopsticks on the pipe organ. Finally, he brought her into the master bedroom and took a plastic bag of marijuana out of his pocket. He rolled a fat joint.
"I got the best shit in Savannah," he said. "You can ask anybody. That's what they'll tell you. Danny Hansford's got great shit. It don't come any stronger. I grow it in the garden out back and dry it in the microwave. It'll get you off for sure."
They smoked the joint. Corinne felt herself becoming lightheaded.
"Do you like me?"
Danny asked, a note of tenderness in his voice.
"Uh-huh,"
she said. He put his arms around her and stroked her back with both hands, caressing her throat lightly with kisses and sending a shiver down her spine. They tumbled onto the four-poster, and he began kissing her breasts, while at the same time pushing her skirt up and pulling down her panties. She reached down to remove her shoes, but before she could do it, he was pressing against her, probing with his fingers, gently and insistently. With the other hand, he unzipped his fly. He took her buttocks tightly in his hands and pulled her toward him as he thrust into her. She breathed the salty smell of his T-shirt and felt his belt buckle rubbing against her stomach. Their rising body heat enclosed them like a steamy towel. It was over soon. He raised his head and looked at her.
"That was great, wasn't it? Huh?
You liked that, didn't you?"
"Uh-huh," she said. "Maybe next time we can even take our clothes off."
Corinne was not taken in by Danny's pretense of being the squire of Mercer House. She knew, as everyone in Savannah knew, that Jim Williams owned the house. But she played along, because the charade seemed